Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon, located on beautiful Vachon Island, Washington, in the middle of Puget Sound. That was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown, and together we, the Briefly, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing to you every week another episode of, quote, intelligent, end of quote, discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Introducing and welcoming our Briefly panel, we have avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer, Kevin Jones. How are you, Kevin?
Good. Still at it.
Good. Keep up the fight. And historian, professor, often navigating by the Southern Cross when not on Vachon, our own guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman.
It's good to be here. And the galaxy needs guarding.
It does need a galaxy or two. Right, that as well. And part-time politico, fairy maven, and self-professed full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreyer. Amy, how you doing zooming in?
You're muted, Amy. You're muted.
Now I'm not muted.
There you
are.
Even better. That's even better.
So you are coming through 4x4. You're in good shape there.
Awesome. All the way from Denver, Colorado.
All right. Mm. How's the weather in Denver? What, wait 15 minutes and you'll get a different, a whole different set of climate conditions?
Yeah, not too bad right now. It's looking like it's just going to be clear and cool for Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. All right. Manning the big board here in the Uptown Gene Bosch Broadcasting Studio, retired Alaska Airline captain and fellow treetop flyer, Truman O'Brien.
Good morning.
Good morning. And I am former Assistant Attorney General, Constitutional Law Professor, and repo man, Craig Bellis. It's a combination.
That's a whole other story.
Those go together.
Yeah. and tell us what you repoed.
I've repoed some things that keeping my head down, I'll tell you that, in downtown San Francisco. It's our great pleasure to be joined by Dr. J. David Hawkins today, endowed professor emeritus, University of Washington School of Social Work, and Vachon singer-songwriter. Actually, his persona as Vachon singer-songwriter is one that most of us know him by, but after this show is over with, you'll know a whole different side to David Hawkins. How you doing today?
I'm great. I'm really honored to be here.
Oh, my goodness. We're honored to have you. We'll be discussing David's groundbreaking work in the prevention of youth behavioral problems in just a moment. But before we start, we are going to ask everyone to recount any favorite moments that they had over the past week. Let's start with Amy. You had anything you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so we had a record-breaking smash burger night at the Eagles last Wednesday night, coinciding with the state president's visit at the Vachon Eagles. Once a year, the state president of all of the Eagles of Washington State makes his way around. And it's usually his way around because many Eagles chapters are not yet integrated, unfortunately. But our Vachon Eagles was one of the first to go co-ed. But I cook once a month. I do smash burgers there once a month on Wednesday nights. And on the 20th, we moved 108 patties in 120 minutes.
Wow. Now, tell our listeners, why is it called a snap burger?
Smash burger.
The local vernacular is smash burger, which it's technically not. It's just an In-N-Out style burger, but it has stubbornly refused to be called anything but a smash burger locally. But it's just In-N-Out style patty. You get your double-double, comes fully dressed, fully loaded for you. And you can have that with a side of fries or tots, all for the low, low price of $10 for a single or $12 for a double.
Wow, you got that down. I'll tell
That's
you.
Right, yep.
Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger.
Betsy.
Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger. Yeah. I'm a burger flipping maestra.
All right. Oh, yes. The feminine. Kevin, how about you?
Well, I just have to say that you have to honor those naming preferences for the burgers. You can't, you don't want to go against the grain on that. It's been an interesting week in that the three-year long-term dedication of the Equity Committee of the Vashon Mori Community Council saw success in our recommendations for the bylaws and standing rules of the Community Council. And as the new board is seated, they will move forward under a new set of ground rules, which basically allows for more people to be included in the council. For example, one of the things that the council strives to do is outreach to different parts of our community. They're called sectors, and they include things like the environment, healthcare, diversity, art, education, culture, health, children and youth, seniors and elderly. It was always a board member who had that responsibility. The new standing rules allow for people to step forward and say, I want to be that liaison in this community to which I may be very well attached, and I'd like to bring my connections and my network into the council. So if that really is inspiring of folks, info@v-mcc.org, you can check in with them and see if they'd like to hear from you.
That's great. That's a great litmus test, too. Anything that will encourage more participation. So good for you. Bruce.
Been a good week. You got my COVID and the flu shot yesterday, so my arm is a little tender, but working. The other thing, of course, is that the Seahawks won.
And actually on
what
top
a game!
They're what
on a game! Amazing game, and followed by it was led into by the game between Washington and Dallas, which was an incredible game.
It was, yeah.
But the Seahawks are on top of the NFC West, so it's so sort of like hard to believe.
Didn't look good there a few weeks ago.
It didn't. So that was interesting. The other thing is tomorrow King County will actually certify the elections from November 5th. And so I was looking through the data by precincts on Vashon. And what's fascinating is between 2016 and 2020 and 2024, over 1,200 people did not vote on Vashon in 2024 compared to 2016. And most of those were Democratic voters. So
really
interesting. The percentages for Trump and the Democrats, Clinton and Harris stayed about the same.
Wow. Are we going to lose our New York Times designation as the most liberal community in the United States?
Well, that's sort of a little stretch.
My brother, who lives in Berkeley, finds that hard to believe.
Well, we voted almost 89% for Democrats the last three elections, so it's pretty liberal here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we'll dive into that later.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see the final certification of that.
It'll be fascinating.
Right. Truman, how about you?
Well, as you know, Craig, I live in a log house out in the woods, right? Heavily wooded. And about
dirt floors, too, isn't it?
Dirt floors, yeah. Sawdust floors.
Reading by candlelight.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, we're modern. We have oil lamps.
Oil lamps, right.
Okay. You're supposed to mix bacon grease in with the
sawdust. Yeah, exactly. Makes them smoke less or more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
So about 4 or 5 days ago, I discovered that we had a rat in the house. And I actually saw the
rat. That's a straight line, if I've ever heard of it.
Yeah, and this rat was, he didn't wear pants, by the way. But this was a big rat. I mean, we're talking the big Norway rat, big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put out traps, nothing. 2 days go by, finally, whack, got him. Right. So I thought, okay, I got that darn rat. But I thought, well, I'll just keep the traps out for a bit longer. 3 days later, I have had 5 rats, 5 in my house.
The whole family.
I could not believe it, but they're all gone now.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah.
We're not having a Christmas party at your
house. No, we're not.
Oh, my. Well, good for you.
Yeah.
You didn't have decide to have a heart and save these rats?
That'd be a negative.
All right. David, how about you?
I got to play music yesterday with three of my very best friends and such good musicians. So I had a very, very fun day yesterday. And before that, I got to go up to Birch Bay and see my sister, who unfortunately has Alzheimer's, but still loves her younger brother. Calls me her big brother because I'm taller than she is. And it was wonderful to see her and spend time with her.
Oh, that's great. And Birch Bay is a beautiful place to visit. Right. Although I bet it was interesting up there with the winds.
No, you know, I was there after all the big winds, and so it was just a lovely couple of days.
Oh, good, good, good. Wow. For me, this last week was my daughter's birthday. Happy birthday, Kate. I just thought I'd say that again. I have an old BMW, as many of you know, and I discovered we have a former Mercedes-certified mechanic from Germany on the island. And he knocked out a little bit of work on that car, did a beautiful job at a really reasonable price. I was very, very happy. Door checks. You know how your doors, you know, sometimes it gets to a point where it won't stay open and it comes back and cracks you on the shin, you know, if you're in the wind or something. Put new door checks in. It just works like a dream.
Perfect.
The other thing was last night, saw Cassandra Lewis at Snapdragon. What a singer, songwriter, entertainer. I was blown away. She sang mostly songs from her, you know, very popular album called Lost in a Dream. If anybody wants to check out Cassandra Lewis, look at Lost in a Dream and listen to some of these. She has a voice that will just blow you away. I was very, very pleased to do that. Okay, in today's history and whatnot. Today is the 26th of November. Occasionally I've gotten that date wrong. And I've had a whole thing here of stuff that was on the wrong day. This one I triple checked. I think I got it right. 35 days remaining in 2024. It's one of these years I'm not going to say good riddance to because I'm afraid of what might be coming up.
Oh boy.
And 55 days until the presidential inauguration on January 20th, 2025. So buckle up.
Buy your Canadian and Mexican import goods now.
That's right. And if you're traveling, get your Canadian travel kit. Okay. So November 26th is National Cake Day, which ironically is also a National Health Day. And it's also one day in this week, which is Better Conversation Week. So we're going to try to have a better conversation today.
We better tune up here.
I know. Jeez, I know. Did you bring cake?
No. But you know what? But I'm engineering for stirring the pot today.
Oh, yeah.
And she says there will be pie.
Oh, there will be pie. Yeah. You're saying that on the air. You might have some other interlopers.
Lined up out the door.
We'll see. Gene Bosch Broadcast Studio. Yeah. Located at.
That's right. Today in history, this is funny. The first three of these all occurred within 3 years of each other. In 1778, British explorer Captain Cook reaches what he called the Sandwich Islands for a while, which is Hawaii, as we call it. He landed on what is now called the island of Maui. That was his first trip. His second trip, he didn't fare quite so well. I guess you would know this, Bruce. He and some of his crew were caught stealing idol tiki gods or whatever for firewood, and they were being chased down the beach by the locals.
Yeah, and they also were trying to recover some things that had been pilfered from the ship, and so it led to a conflict.
Right, back and forth.
Yes, right, yes. So,
and Captain Cook got the wrong end of that stick.
He did.
Oh, boy. I actually walked down the hillside to the bay where their ships were moored and where he lost his life.
Oh.
And there's a plaque. It's actually out in the water. And it's apparently he fell like steps from the shore when he was on his way to the longboat, I guess, to get back to the ship. But he didn't escape their grasp.
Wow.
1789 on this day. It was the first national Thanksgiving celebrated in America, one of the first four national holidays. Does anybody know what the first four national holidays were? You know one of them, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
Yeah, Bruce, you know?
Duh.
No, yeah.
Oh, well, what? God, I find that hard to believe.
Christmas, New Year's, and the Independence Day, 4th of July.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
So you learned something by listening to this show.
No bratwurst recognition holidays or
none of those that we talk about every week. And then in 1791, the first cabinet meeting was held at George Washington's home in Philadelphia. And they had perhaps a more august cabinet than we're looking at today. They had Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton, the Secretary of War Henry Knox were amongst the attendees. Wow. A couple more. In 1922, the English archaeologist Howard Carter opened Tutankhamun's virtually intact tomb, which we all know was made famous by Steve Martin's unforgettable 1978 Saturday Night Live skit and song, King Tut.
Indeed we do. Don't have the soundtrack ready, do we?
No, I'm sorry.
I should have mentioned that.
I should have had it up.
You can look that up, I'm sure, in an internet search.
Yeah. That's right. Yes. In 1948, the first Polaroid camera sold for $89.75 in Boston at the Jordan Marsh department store. And remember, don't shake your Polaroid film. Mm-hmm. Which everybody wants to do.
I did not know that.
Because it's chemical. Right. And if you shake it hard enough, the chemicals actually could run into one another. Mm-hmm. At least they could for a while.
So
I think
psychedelic photographs.
Yeah. That's right. And finally, in 1968, the 34th Heisman Trophy was awarded to?
O.J. Simpson.
O.J. Simpson. Very good, Bruce. Yep. That's right. O.J. Simpson.
But who finished second, third, and fourth?
I don't know.
Leroy Keyes. From Purdue was second. Terry Hanratty, quarterback from Notre Dame, was third. And Ted Kaulick from Penn State was fourth. Tight end, quarterback, and two running backs.
Wow. Yeah.
So you've never heard of the others.
Well, I've heard of Hanratty.
But O.J. is on the top.
That's right. I've heard of Kaulick. People accuse me of having been licked by 1,000 cows.
as have most attorneys.
That's right. You can't let it out, can you?
Can't leave it alone.
All right, enough tomfoolery. Or as I say, all seriousness aside, we're going to talk to David Hawkins now as part of our, or not part of, all of our small talk segment. And David is somebody who I met at the Coop, having sung his singing at the Coop, and at two Paul Caldwell, concerts, fundraising concerts at the high school for the music scholarships. And David is a delightful individual. And as I found out here in the last several weeks, is not only a great musician and singer, but has another career which is even more amazing. And we will find out about that. How are you doing today, David?
I'm great.
Good. Let's see. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you ended up on Vashon.
I'm a recovering probation officer. I worked with delinquent kids for a while early in life. Wondered why those kids had gotten to that place by the time that they had. I was trying to help them stay in school, and they didn't like school. I was trying to help them stay in their homes. Their families were places of conflict instead of places of love and affection. And I gave that job up and always wondered if there was something we could do to prevent those kinds of problems from developing in the first place. I ended up at the University of Washington. I have a sociology degree from Northwestern University. And at the University of Washington, I had the opportunity to get involved in thinking about how could we actually prevent delinquency before it happens. And so my career was really working on the prevention of delinquent behavior before kids get involved in delinquency.
Wow. So you're currently a professor emeritus at the University of Washington?
That's right. Retired. I moved to, we've had our place here since the early 1980s, and I was one of the summer people. Uh-huh. Then in 2021, kind of in the midst of the pandemic, I said, I could live here full time. I'm retired now, and I do.
Great. Well, full disclosure, this is Truman, by the way. Before I began flying for a living, I was actually the director of a counseling center down at Fort Lewis and working with some of those kids before they got to you.
Yeah.
I'm sure may have been about the same time, actually. So what got you started doing this research and trying to prevent bad youth behaviors?
Friends of mine in the sociology department had a grant from the Federal Department of Justice to say, what do we know about the prevention of delinquency? And they knew that I'd been involved in work with delinquent kids, and so they said, Dave, could you get involved with us in this? I said, sure. And we started looking at what had been done in the past to prevent delinquency. And there'd been 9 true experiments. Kids randomly assigned to either get the service or not get the service. None of those experiments were effective in actually preventing delinquency. In the early 1980s, there was no evidence that you could prevent delinquency before it happens. When we looked around at other fields, we said, you know, in cardiovascular disease, there's been a lot of work done on prevention. How did they do that? Well, they identified risk factors, factors that when present earlier in development increase the likelihood of heart or lung disease, and also protective factors. And we all know what they are. We know that smoking is a risk factor, sedentary lifestyle is a risk factor, et cetera. And today, you can't smoke in the Jean Bosch studio.
Right.
you could have if there were such a thing 30 years ago. And today in America, at least, if you don't exercise, you feel guilty. We have had a change in lifestyle, and we've had over 30% reduction in cardiovascular disease. So we said, let's apply the same approach to the prevention of delinquency. There have been a lot of longitudinal studies following people forward, population studies, epidemiological studies, that show that certain risk factors, characteristics of communities, of families, of schools, of individuals, increase the likelihood of risk. And so we said, let's think about reducing and preventing delinquency by reducing known risk factors and increasing known protective factors. And so in our work, we said, when can we start this at a time when you can get the whole population? And in those years, we didn't have much in terms of early childhood education. And so we said first grade is a time to start. You've got everybody in the public schools in the first grade. We went to the Seattle Public Schools, and that's a long story itself and how we were able to get an experiment going within the Seattle Public Schools. But we decided to try to compare kids whose teachers were trained in better methods of classroom instruction and management and whose parents were offered workshops developmentally adjusted during the first 6 grades of elementary school to see if we could increase the likelihood that protective factors developed and decrease the likelihood of risk factors. School failure in the late grades of elementary school is a risk factor. Losing your commitment to school in the late grades of elementary school is a risk factor. Family conflict is a big risk factor. Parents who don't know how to set clear expectations for their kids and who are inconsistent in discipline, these are all things that are risk factors that we thought we could change. And we developed a simple-minded theory that we said, we're going to use this theory that we call the social development strategy and make sure that everything that we do tries to increase the likelihood of protection developing in the lives of these kids in school and in home.
Amy, before you ask the question, I think you were going to dig a little deeper into that, into that last comment that that David made. Just so people know, a longitudinal study, that's not a study from the North Pole to the South Pole to the North Pole. What is a longitudinal study?
A longitudinal study just means you follow people forward over time. You pick them up at a certain point, you've got a sample, and you try to keep all the people in that sample in the study and collect data on them over the next 5, 10, 15 years. We've been following these kids in the Seattle study that I'm telling you about since they were 6. They're now in their 40s.
Yeah.
And we've been collecting data on them every year.
That is truly a long term. Truman, you had a quick question?
Yeah, just one thing that I find really interesting. I was working with kids at the Fort Lewis So these are military dependents. And so I find this really interesting. They had this discipline and the structure that you're talking about. And so consequently, most of the behaviors that we were dealing with were not that aberrant. Mm-hmm. We just had some, you know, typical teenage angst mm-hmm. that was going on. We did have a couple of runaways, and they came and told me they were going. And I said, don't tell me where, because I'll tell your parents. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's my job. Yeah. But if you can tell me you're going, that's fine. And I gave them some rules that they had to follow, and they did. But I think that's really interesting that because these kids had that development up to their teenage years, that we had less of the problems.
Absolutely, because you have less of one of the risk factors.
Exactly. Discipline and
probably less family conflict and probably parents who are clear about setting expectations.
That's
for
the
behavior.
Main thing, I think. Yeah.
And following through.
Interesting.
Amy, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering, thank you for kind of giving us a good, robust description, but can you talk about, I'm curious, you know, introducing that in the schools is one thing, but introducing it in homes is a much bigger challenge. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about sort of how you operationalized this and introduced it into homes?
Yeah, we had people who were a part of our project that were called Family Life Educators, and when the kids were going to enter the first grade, the Family Life Educators went out to the homes of the first graders that were in the experimental condition and said, I'm such and so. I know that your son or daughter is going to be a member of our class, and we want to welcome your son or daughter to our class. This is Mrs. What's-her-name, the teacher, and she will be really glad to meet your son, and I'd like to know a little about your son so I can let the teacher know about it. So the first contact from school in our project was a positive contact, an opportunity for parents to hear from the school about have a reach out from the school about their family. And so later, when we offered voluntary workshops for the parents, the first one was called Catch 'em Being Good, the importance of positive recognition for positive behavior. Those parents already had met that family life educator, knew who that person was, and so were more likely to participate, even though 40% of the families in our study were single parent families with people struggling to make ends meet. They were more likely to come because that was a positive reach out at the beginning from the school. The first time you heard from the school was not your kids doing bad things from the teacher, but a positive reach out from the family life educator.
Yeah, for sure. And did you, I mean, it's easy to make it assumptions, but how did you select which kids? Was it sort of across the board?
Universal.
Or did you...
It was okay, universal. Yeah. And we're doing this for every... One of the things that people don't understand is that the kids who get in trouble, some of them are the highest risk kids. But if you really look at the population, it turns out that middle level risk kids are a much larger portion of the population. And because a large number of them do get in trouble, it ends up if you only focus on the highest risk kids, you'll never really reduce the prevalence of delinquent or criminal behavior in the population. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing a universal intervention, teaching teachers better methods of teaching and offering parents these workshops that could help improve their family education and mm-hmm. skills as parenting.
Kevin, did you have something?
And understand that hundreds of students were involved in the project for, you know, 3 decades or so that you followed them in this longitudinal study. So just really fascinated with the outcomes that you identified. But I understand there's something called preventive interventions that you provided in this research. Can you tell us about that?
So preventive interventions just mean that the things that we did that were different from what teachers would normally do or what parents would normally do. So for the teachers, the preventive interventions were better methods of classroom management and instruction. So just to give some examples, often teachers try to start teaching at the beginning of the year, whatever the subject matter is. In our classrooms, the first things the teacher did was to talk about what's it like to be in this classroom and how can we learn to get along in this classroom so you never have to get yelled at by the teacher. If anybody's been yelled at by a teacher, raise your hand. Kids who raise their hand. How many liked it? Nobody raised their hand. How would you like to learn something that would mean you never have to get yelled at? We'd all like to learn that. So that's creating the mental set for wanting to learn. And then the teacher would say, these are the days of overhead projectors. So the teacher would say, okay, if you're talking, if it's too loud in this classroom, I'm going to flip the overhead projector switch 3 times. And what that means is mouths shut, eyes forward, looking at the teacher, everybody quiet. You think you can do it? Let's practice. And you'd actually teach the skill and practice the skill as a way of classroom management. Another example of classroom management is actually using what we call the law of least intervention. If two kids are talking in the back of the class, you can say, Bill, John, please be quiet. Well, what that does is focus attention on those kids, and all the other kids say, ha ha, Bill and John got in trouble. But if the teacher just continues his or her lecture and walks back and stands next to those kids continuing to talk, those kids will be quiet, and no time has been lost from instruction. So law of least intervention, 2 examples from a number of things that we taught. The teachers got 5 days of in-service training each year. Another part was interactive teaching. In interactive teaching, you check with all the kids in the class to see who knows what 6 times 9 is if you're teaching multiplication. A teacher can say, who knows what 6 times 9 is? The smart kids, the bright kids, the eager kids in the front of the class will raise their hand. You call on one of those kids, they'll get it right. And the kids who sit in the U around the edge of the classroom will say, phew, I got away with it. I didn't have to even think about it. And so that's different than if a teacher says, okay, class, what's 6 times 9? Write it on your ThinkPad. 1, 2, 3, show me. Then the teacher can see how many kids have that material. And that means I'm checking for the whole class and not just the eager kids. So you see, these aren't big differences, but they change the way the classroom is a place of opportunity for involvement for kids. When 60% of the kids have the material, the teacher then can put them into what are called cooperative learning groups, in which kids work with each other to make sure everybody has the material. A lot of parents hate cooperative learning groups because they say, my kid's doing all the work for the other kids. That's because the cooperative learning groups aren't structured right. They need to be structured so that everybody gets rewarded if everybody improves. And if you structure them correctly, cooperative learning actually enhances peer influence in the pursuit of learning. Usually in classrooms, peer influence is pushing you away from learning. But in classrooms that use cooperative learning with reward interdependence, the kids want other kids to do well on their team because then their team gets recognized. They get their picture on the wall or they get to line up first for recess. And so by creating that, the able kids are working at the application level, reteaching it to a kid who didn't get it. And the other kid is more likely to understand it because that kid is talking to him at his level and it's not the teacher trying to teach it again the second time who didn't get it fully through the first time.
Well, so we should have been around when I had Sister Mary Honolulu.
Yeah.
So those are just examples of the intervention. What do we mean by preventive intervention? Better methods of how to teach and manage classroom.
Bruce.
When did this study start? When did you start this with the Seattle Public Schools?
We started it in 1981, the first graders in the beginning of 1981.
So is it still going on? How is it developed, emerged, sort of shifted over the years? That's 30 years ago.
Yeah, we did the project for 6 years, and one of the things that's disappointing about that project is that once the 6-year experiment was done in the schools, the Seattle district didn't choose to pick that project up.
Interesting.
It was a grant-funded project, and they didn't choose to pick it up. Teachers in the individual buildings that were using it continued to use their skills. People used to come up to me afterwards and say, that was the best experience I had in 30 years of teaching, and I continue to use those practices. But we had made a mistake. We were so focused on getting the knowledge, seeing if it really worked, that we were really doing an experiment, and we didn't really work on broadening the support for this kind of an approach within the larger community and within the public school system itself. Mm-hmm. And that was a learning for us. It led us to a second major project that we did that is called Communities of Care, in which we really changed our strategy. And I could talk more about that later, but yeah. So,
great.
Truman, you were going to, I think, follow up on that a bit.
Yeah, I am. Communities that care, CTC. Prevention Operating System is what it says. So what have been the results of this? And is this an effective tool? And is it working going forward?
Yeah, if it's all right, I'd like to backtrack just a little bit.
Please.
To the Seattle project and actually talk about the results of that project.
Yes.
So first grade we start. By the end of the second grade, the teachers in the experimental classrooms are rating the boys as less aggressive and less externalizing behaviors, less likely to push other kids, hit other kids, yell at other kids, get in trouble, and the girls as less self-destructive. When we follow those kids up at 39 years of age, they are actually having better health and better success in life. So statistically significant differences, everything I'm going to talk about is statistically significant. I'm not going to keep saying that anymore. But 32 years later, they're 39 years old, they have overall better mental and physical health indicated by fewer symptoms of depression and anxiety, better general health, less obesity, less people with high blood pressure, and better economic success. Higher proportion exceeding U.S. median socioeconomic status, more owning their own home or condominium, less dependence on public assistance between the ages of 30 and 39, and also more health maintenance behaviors, exercise, getting adequate sleep, and stress management. These risk factors that we addressed in school and family had effects much more broadly. They did better on California achievement tests by the end of the sixth grade, significantly less violent delinquent acts by the age of 18, less heavy drinking by the age of 18, and less pregnancy, teen pregnancy by the age of 18. And it just goes on and on.
What about suicide?
Suicide. Actually, we do. That paper isn't yet published, but we see significant reductions in suicide through the age of 39. So we have the institution of the public school system. We are not necessarily training teachers in the best methods for instruction to ensure that all kids have opportunities for active learning in the classroom, that all kids develop the skills they need to succeed, and that they're recognized and reinforced for their effort and their improvement and their achievement. When those things happen, kids get more bonded to school. And when kids feel bonded to school, it means they like their teacher, they want to do well, they want the teacher to be happy with them. And then, if we say, you really need to do your homework this weekend, they're more likely to do it. We can change that dynamic of social bonding by using these better methods of instruction and family management. And that'll change kids' lives in a lot of dimensions.
So just before we get into CTC, I'm just curious, to what extent has the Vashon Island School District aware of or practicing, or have you had a chance to approach anybody in the local school district?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that one of the parenting curricula that we used in that project, which is called Guiding Good Choices, is actually provided here on Vashon. It was just provided this past spring. And it's a good program. It's been tested independently by other researchers than our group and shown to reduce the likelihood of early initiation of substance use, as well as the proportion of kids who continue to get involved in drug use.
So my question is, in any research project, you generally have a control group. How did you manage that? Did you look at other classrooms that were not using this method?
Absolutely. We chose schools in which there were at least two first grade classrooms, it was a flip of the coin actually within schools, which teacher would get these practices and which teacher would go on with his or her teaching in the normal way. There are advantages of that from a research standpoint. There are disadvantages of that from trying to change a whole school culture because you can't do it that way.
Right.
But we really wanted to know, does this make a difference? Because all the earlier experiments often sounded like good ideas. You know, give kids drug education and information. Well, a lack of information about drugs is not one of the major risk factors for drug use. So when in the schools, you may remember there were years when we used to take drugs into school and say, this is bad for you, don't use it. Yeah. And you'd pass a baggie of marijuana around and hope it got back to the front of the room. and so information, lack of information about drugs wasn't really a major risk factor, and therefore giving kids information wasn't a solution. And so you really need to think about what are the risk factors from the longitudinal studies that need to be addressed and changed.
Wow.
So do we have a definition now or of the attributes of communities that care? The CTs?
No, we didn't get to that. We can do that now.
Thanks.
Good question. Communities of care. It's a five. What's happened in the last 40 years is now there's a project like the Seattle Social Development Project that's got this intervention, this preventive intervention that we know works. And so you could use that if you want to use that. Well, there are 70 tested effective prevention projects now that are really tested and well-controlled trials that you could use. So the struggle for today for communities is not just to say, what do you think we should do? It's to really choose the most effective program for your community, given that communities have different norms and standards, different kinds of problems in one community from another community, different resources. And so the question is, how do you choose the right preventive interventions for your community, given what we know about the community? And so communities of care is a five-phase process. The first is just get started. The key leaders of the community, the superintendent of schools, the leader of the community council, the people who control resources and shape opinion, need to decide we want to use this system. The second phase is I used to say, if the police chief and the school superintendent won't ride in the same car together to hear about communities of care, the community's not ready for this.
No.
You've got to have a willingness for people to collaborate, to work together as a community. The second stage is get organized. So you actually create a coalition if there's not one existing, and there are committees of that coalition that have to do with resources, that have to do with looking at risk and protective factors in the community, et cetera, and organizing work groups to do the work. The third phase is actually developing a profile of what are the levels of risk in this community and the levels of protection in this community. And we get that from doing surveys in the 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th grade in the school. And that survey is actually done in the Vashon schools. It's now administered by the state of Washington. It's called the Healthy You Survey. And our survey is used by many school districts in Washington. So you don't have to actually do a special survey. You can actually look at the data that's collected every 2 years. And you'll see which risk factors are elevated compared to other risk factors. And those are the ones you want to address in your preventive interventions. And so step three is develop that profile of risk and protection. And then step four is to develop an action plan. Here are the preventive interventions we want to add to our community, given what we already have here. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. There are wonderful programs on Vashon Island that you want to supplement and add to, not necessarily replace. In fact, you don't want to replace it. So that's what happens in step four. And step five, then, is implement. And every 2 years, you get to look at the survey to see, are things changing in the desired direction? Are the risk factors going down? Are the protective factors getting stronger? And that can be repeated. So there are communities across the nation now who have been using communities of care for over 20 years and are able to see progress over a long period of time.
Just a quick question. I mean, this is all evidence-based, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so how do you convince school boards and communities that begin to question evidence? How do you deal? I mean, we're in a situation where truth is under attack, if you will, and evidence is always subjective in many people's minds. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think, I don't know if we have the real full answer to that question right now in America, but I would say the first thing is, I believe that everybody wants better outcomes for their children. I believe that no matter what your own background experience is, you want your kids to do better. And so if you can say, look, this is what happened with kids who got this, and this is what happened with kids who didn't get this, that is evidence. And if you don't want to pay attention to that evidence, you can go with your gut, but there is evidence that suggests that this leads to better outcomes. And communities of care has that kind of evidence of I haven't really mentioned it to you, but if you look at communities of care, you'll find by the end of the eighth grade, those proportion of kids who used alcohol was 32% lower than in control communities. Proportion who had used cigarettes was 33% lower than in control communities. Proportion who had started criminal behavior, 25% lower than those in control communities. So you can either say, okay, show me the evidence, or you can say, I don't want to see the evidence. But if you want the better outcomes, hopefully you want to see the evidence.
Amy, did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering, you mentioned that this is, you know, kind of going nationwide. Have you had any chance to sort of study different geographies, right? Like, where success was success experienced at the same rate in different regions of the country?
Yeah.
What do you know about that?
When Tom Ridge was the governor of Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania adopted communities of care on a statewide basis. And there's been a 16-year study that's published study that shows that about 50% of communities actually adopted CTC in Pennsylvania and about 50% didn't. So it's about a half and half. And what they found was that when they did the 16-year study, looking at their surveys every couple of years, that there were significant reductions in the lifetime use of cigarettes, marijuana, and any other drugs, current use of alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana, binge drinking, drunk or high at school, ever having been arrested, arrested, suspended from school, or having sold illegal drugs in the past year, and significantly fewer symptoms of depression. So you get this statewide study from Pennsylvania. It's also been adopted in communities in Australia, and you can see they've done some nice research there, also suggesting more positive outcomes in terms of drug use and delinquent behavior in there. So there's over 150.
So you're going to take this.
Over 150 communities across the nation are currently using communities of care. State of Colorado has adopted on a statewide basis. There are programs going in about 18 different states right now. And there are also other countries have been very interested in communities of care. So it's being used in Austria, Germany, Sweden, Ireland, Estonia, Switzerland, Chile, and Colombia.
Wow.
So. Fantastic. And yeah. Is there a sort of one body that promotes this,
yeah,
or is this all through the UW?
Yes. The thing, it's a long story, and I know we don't have enough time for long stories, but actually, this program was at one point, Communities of Care, the system was adopted, was bought, purchased from a developer. We were the developers. We developed outside the university. In the old days, you couldn't get research money to develop things. You could only get money to test them. So we actually developed, my research partner, Richard Catalano, and I developed this community secure system privately. And at some point, a developer came along and said, we want to buy this. We want evidence-based. We want this. So they bought it from us. And they provided it for a while. But they said, you know, we don't make enough money on this. There's so much doggone training. You know, we were used to publishing brochures and getting paid.
A doggone capitalism.
Yeah. So the federal government, SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, purchased it from them and said, we'll do this here. But all they did was put it up on their website. And so we at the university kept getting calls from people who wanted to really use it and say, we need the training and technical assistance. So it ends up in the end that the National Institute on Drug Abuse gave us resources at the university to actually create an online training system for this communities of care. And that now is provided through this the Social Development Research Group at the University of Washington. It's called the Center for Communities of Care. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested, it's www.communitiesatcare.net. And all the information that you need is accessible there to get involved with communities of care.
Wonderful.
That's terrific. You know, this whole topic just fascinates me. You're talking about these longitudinal studies that have been done in these areas over the course of the switch from television to social media.
Yeah, the phones in the classroom.
Exactly, exactly. The different philosophies of parenting, consumerism, all sorts of other variables. And over this period of decades, you've been able to accomplish and reach these goals. Do you account for those kinds of changes?
I'm glad you asked this question. There, I have on the fingers of one hand five principles that are protective principles that I think every parent and every teacher, every sports leader should think this way. Five things that young people need. I think what's five things that we all need in any organization. The first thing is opportunities for active involvement. You've got to have a chance to be actively engaged in it. So you're a mom of an infant, you pick up the baby. The baby doesn't just all stay in the lay-it. If you're the teacher of a first grade classroom, all the kids get to feed the gerbils once in a while. So opportunities for active involvement. The second thing is the skills to be successful in your opportunities. When we decided we were going to put this social development strategy in place in our family, my wife said, I'll keep cooking. My son said, I'll set the table. And my daughter said, I'll clear the table. I said, I'll do the dishes. The next morning, my wife came down to the kitchen, and she said, Dave, I thought you did the dishes last night. And I said, I did the dishes. She said, what about the counters? And I said, well, what do you mean, what about the counters? She said, there were some milk stains and, you know, milk spills and some plastic bags on the counters. She said, what about the counters, Maureen? And she said, Dave, when you wash the dishes, you do the counters. And I'm a good counterman now. But I just tell you that if I, as the dad, didn't have the skills to do it to my family specifications, how do we expect the kids to do it unless we teach the skills, not just say, go clean your room, help them learn to do it if they don't know how. Mm-hmm. So opportunity, skills. And the third piece is recognition and reinforcement for skillful performance, for effort, for improvement, and for achievement. If you reward effort, improvement, and achievement, kids start to feel differently about you. They like you. They feel attached to you. They feel part of that unit. Bonding is what develops. And social bonding is the key, because if you feel bonded to a social group, then you care what the standards for behavior are. Mrs. Reagan said to kids, just say no. No one cared what she said. That's because they weren't bonded to her. But if it's your mom who's telling you that and you're bonded to her, or your teacher and you're bonded, or your coach, and your coach says, I don't want you smoking marijuana, when you know, then you're more likely to pay attention. And that's the fifth thing. Healthy, clear standards for behavior. That goes across time. It goes across with cell phones, without cell phones. It goes across all different changes. Opportunity, skills, recognition, build bonding. Bonding is important because it provides motivation to live according to the standards. Be clear and explicit about your standards for behavior.
Wow, that's great. This program will be archived so people can listen to it again or for the first time by going to voiceofashon.org. I'm curious, very simple question. Are there any personality changes that have been, I mean, other than these metrics that you have been looking at, have you looked at behavioral changes, morale, stages of moral development, things along those lines that are a result of these interventions and programs?
Well, I would say probably the closest to that is just looking at how people are living at age 39. Mm-hmm. From 31 to 39, this period of early midlife, you know. And if you look at it, there's three domains that we looked at: healthy behavior, positive functioning, and this health maintenance behaviors. And what we see is in all three of those areas, you have people who are living a healthier life, who are more productive and successful economically, and who are also taking better care of their health by their practices.
Probably have a better self-image as well. They know themselves better.
Probably. Yeah. I don't have that.
No, that's tough to measure.
Not just
too.
Reality data. I have to have data.
Well, you could intuit it. Before we go, I just have to ask you about your alter ego. When did you start playing the guitar and singing and writing songs?
I started playing the guitar when I was 15, and I've been playing the guitar ever since. But you wouldn't know it from my skills, because until I retired, which was really in 2020, I played a lot of guitar, but I didn't really get better. I've written a number of songs. I'm now really trying to focus on music as my avocation and my vocation at this time. And I'll just put in a plug. Friends and I are playing at the Roastery on December 7th from 11 to 1, and Wilson Abbott will be there, Gene Richstadt will be there, I'll be there, Mike Whitmer will be there, and my friend Matthew Felton from Seattle, who I've been playing with for the last decade, who's a keyboard player, gifted keyboard player, will all be playing.
What was the date again?
December 7th, 11 to 1 at the Roastery.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. How much time we got left, Truman?
About 4 minutes.
I did want to get into a whole other area, but I'm not going to. But as I was listening to this conversation, reading some of the things that your group has developed, I thought, is there any relevance to perhaps the... What some people have referred to as the bro culture that perhaps helped Trump be elected to president. You got any thought on that?
Two things about that. One is what you see is that these teaching practices that we talked about in Seattle, they got boys to be less aggressive in the early elementary grades, and they made kids like school better. I think what bro culture comes from is a school system and school districts and schools that are not doing a great job of really getting boys to get bonded to school and care about education. And as a result, because we're not teaching ways that bring boys in, girls keep getting better and better. Our girls, you know, are excelling in education. More girls are getting college degrees, etc. We've got to work better on how we reach boys in our schools. One other thing I would just say about that. There was a big study done, just published this last month in Chicago, in the Bronzeville community of Chicago. 3 to 9 times rates of violent offending in that part of Chicago than in the rest of Chicago. A minister in Chicago says, I want to do evidence-based prevention. I want to prevent this violence that's going on in our community. He mobilized that community, and there are 70 different organizations working together using the communities of care system. They use official police records of robberies and of aggravated assaults of murder, et cetera, homicides, et cetera, and they have found significant reductions in significant reductions in robberies and aggravated assaults in a inner city African American community. You can do these things and make a difference in people's lives anywhere.
That's fantastic. I mean, I really do appreciate you coming in. We've learned a lot. I think we've scratched the surface, but
Can we have him back every week?
Yeah, I was going to say I think we've given people a bit of a Whitman sampler of a lot of the wonderful work that you've done, David. We appreciate that very much. Next week, Truman. It's the Truman Show.
Oh my gosh.
You'll have probably a load of issues, man, that we could talk about.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Yeah, buckle up, folks.
Yeah, we'll talk about current events next week on The Truman Show. Let's see. Okay, for Bruce, Kevin, Amy, Truman, and our guest, Dr. J. David Hawkins, I'm Craig. We thank you for listening, and we all wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.